Hello, and welcome to Family Folktales from the Nashville Public Library. I'm Susan Poulter, a librarian at the Main Library. Today's story is Prince Vivien and the Princess Placida, a French tale found in Andrew Lang's Green Fairy Book. Once upon a time, there lived a king and queen who loved one another dearly. Indeed, the queen, whose name was Santorina, was so pretty and so kind-hearted that it would have been a wonder if her husband had not been fond of her, while King Gridelin himself was a perfect bundle of good qualities, for the fairy who presided at his christening had summoned the shades of all his ancestors and taken something good from each of them to form his character. Unfortunately, though, she had given him rather too much kindness of heart, which is a thing that generally gets its possessor into trouble. But so far, all things had prospered with King Gridelin. However, it was not to be expected such good fortune could last. And before very long, the queen had a lovely little daughter who was named Placida. Now, the king, who thought that if she resembled her mother in face and mind, she would need no other gift, never troubled to ask any of the fairies to her christening. And this offended them mortally, so that they resolved to punish him severely for thus depriving them of their rights. So, to the despair of King Gridelin, the queen first of all became very ill, and then disappeared altogether. If it had not been for the little princess, there is no saying what would have become of him, he was so miserable. But there she was to be brought up, and luckily the good fairy Lolotte, in spite of all that had passed, was willing to come and take charge of her, and of her little cousin Prince Vivien, who was an orphan, and had been placed under the care of his uncle King Gridelin when he was quite a baby. Although she neglected nothing that could possibly have been done for them, their characters as they grew up plainly proved that education only softens down natural defects, but cannot entirely do away with them. For Placida, who was perfectly lovely, and with a capacity and intelligence which enabled her to learn and understand anything that presented itself, was at the same time as lazy and indifferent as it is possible for anyone to be. While Vivien, on the contrary, was only too lively and was forever taking up some new thing and as promptly tiring of it and flying off to something else which held his fickle fancy an equally short time. As these two children would possibly inherit the kingdom, it was natural that their people should take a great interest in them, and it fell out that all the tranquil and peace-loving citizens desired that Placida should one day be their queen, while the rash and quarrelsome hoped great things for Vivien. Such a division of ideas seemed to promise civil wars and all kinds of troubles to the state, and even in the palace, the two parties frequently came into collision. As for the children themselves, though they were too well brought up to quarrel, still the difference in all their tastes and feelings made it impossible for them to like one another. So there seemed no chance of their ever consenting to be married, which was a pity, since that was the only thing that would have satisfied both parties. Prince Vivien was fully aware of the feeling in his favor, but being too honorable to wish to injure his pretty cousin, and perhaps too impatient and volatile to care to think seriously about anything, he suddenly took it into his head that he would go off by himself in search of adventure. Luckily, this idea occurred to him when he was on horseback, for he would certainly have set out on foot rather than lose an instant. As it was, he simply turned his horse's head without another thought than that of getting out of the kingdom as soon as possible. This abrupt departure was a great blow to the state, especially as no one had any idea what had become of the prince. Even King Gridelin, who had never cared for anything since the disappearance of Queen Santorina, was roused by this new loss. And though he could not so much as look at the Princess Placida without shedding floods of tears, he resolved to see for himself what talents and capabilities she showed. He very soon found out that in addition to her natural indolence, she was being as much indulged and spoiled day by day as if the fairy had been her grandmother, and was obliged to remonstrate very seriously upon the subject. Lolotte took his reproaches meekly and promised faithfully that she would not encourage the princess in her idleness and indifference any more. From this moment, poor Placida's troubles began. She was actually expected to choose her own dresses, to take care of her jewels, and to find her own amusements. But rather than take so much trouble, she wore the same old frock from morning till night, and never appeared in public if she could possibly avoid it. However, this was not all. King Gridelin insisted that the affairs of the kingdom should be explained to her, and that she should attend all the councils and give her opinion upon the matter in hand whenever it was asked of her. And this made her life such a burden to her that she implored Lolotte to take her away from a country where too much was required of an unhappy princess. The fairy refused at first with a great show of firmness. But who could resist the tears and entreaties of anyone so pretty as Placida? It came to this in the end, that she transported the princess just as she was, cozily tucked up upon her favorite couch, to her own grotto. And this new disappearance left all the people in despair, and Gridelin went about looking more distracted than ever. But now let us return to Prince Vivien and see what his restless spirit has brought him to. Though Placida's kingdom was a large one, his horse had carried him gallantly to the limit of it, but it could go no further, and the prince was obliged to dismount and continue his journey on foot, though this slow mode of progress tired his patience severely. After what seemed to him a very long time, he found himself all alone in a vast forest, so dark and gloomy that he secretly shuddered. However, he chose the most promising-looking path he could find and marched along it courageously at his best speed. But in spite of all his efforts, night fell before he reached the edge of the wood. For some time he stumbled along, keeping to the path as well as he could in the darkness, and just as he was almost wearied out, he saw before him a gleam of light. This sight revived his drooping spirits, and he made sure that he was now close to the shelter and supper he needed so much. But the more he walked towards the light, the further away it seemed. Sometimes he even lost sight of it altogether, and you may imagine how provoked and impatient he was by the time he finally arrived at the miserable cottage from which the light proceeded. He gave a loud knock at the door, and an old woman's voice answered from within. But as she did not seem to be hurrying herself to open it, he redoubled his blows and demanded to be let in imperiously, quite forgetting that he was no longer in his own kingdom. But all this had no effect upon the old woman, who only noticed all the uproar he was making by saying gently, "You must have patience." He could hear that she really was coming to open the door to him, only she was so very long about it. First, she chased away her cat, lest it should run away when the door was opened. Then he heard her talking to herself and made out that her lamp wanted trimming, that she might see better who it was that knocked, and then that it lacked fresh oil and she must refill it. So what with one thing and another, she was an immense time trotting to and fro, and all the while she now and again bade the prince have patience. When at last he stood within the little hut, he saw with despair that it was a picture of poverty, and that not a crumb of anything eatable was to be seen. And when he explained to the old woman that he was dying of hunger and fatigue, she only answered tranquilly that he must have patience. However, she presently showed him a bundle of straw on which he could sleep. "But what can I have to eat?" cried Prince Vivian sharply. "Wait a little, wait a little," she replied. "If you will only have patience, I am just going out into the garden to gather some peas. We will shell them at our leisure. Then I will light a fire and cook them, and when they are thoroughly done, we can enjoy them peaceably. There is no hurry." "I shall have died of starvation by the time all that is done," said the prince ruefully. "Patience, patience," said the old woman. "I can't be hurried. All things come to him who waits. You must have heard that often." Prince Vivian was wild with aggravation, but there was nothing to be done. "Come then," said the old woman. "You shall hold the lamp to light me while I pick peas." The prince in his haste snatched it up so quickly that it went out, and it took him a long time to light it again with two little bits of glowing charcoal which he had to dig out from the pile of ashes upon the hearth. However, at last the peas were gathered and shelled and the fire lighted, but then they had to be carefully counted, since the old woman declared that she would cook 54 and no more. In vain did the prince represent to her that he was famished, that 54 peas would go no way toward satisfying his hunger, that a few peas more or less surely could not matter. It was quite useless. In the end, he had to count out the 54, and worse than that, because he dropped one or two in his hurry, he had to begin again from the very first to be sure the number was complete. As soon as they were cooked, the old dame took a pair of scales and a morsel of bread from the cupboard and was just about to divide it when Prince Vivian, who really could wait no longer, seized the whole piece and ate it up, saying in his turn, "Patience." "You mean that for a joke," said the old woman, as gently as ever. "But that is really my name, and some day you will know more about me." Then they each ate their 27 peas, and the prince was surprised to find that he wanted nothing more, and he slept as sweetly upon his bed of straw as he had ever done in his palace. In the morning, the old woman gave him milk and bread for his breakfast, which he ate contentedly, rejoicing that there was nothing to be gathered or counted or cooked. And when he had finished, he begged her to tell him who she was. "That I will with pleasure," she replied, "but it will be a long story." "Oh, if it's long, I can't listen," cried the prince. "But," said she, "at your age, you should attend to what old people say and learn to have patience." But, said the prince in his most impatient tone, "old people should not be so long-winded. Tell me what country I've got into and nothing else." "With all my heart," said she, "you are in the forest of the Black Bird. It is here that he utters his oracles." "An oracle!" cried the prince. "Oh, I must go and consult him." Thereupon he drew a handful of gold from his pocket and offered it to the woman. And when she would not take it, he threw it down upon the table and was off like a flash of lightning, without even staying to ask the way. He took the first path that presented itself and followed it at the top of his speed, often losing his way or stumbling over some stone or running up against a tree, and leaving behind him, without regret, the cottage which had been as little to his taste as the character of its possessor. After some time, he saw in the distance a huge black castle which commanded a view of the whole forest. The prince felt certain that this must be the abode of the oracle, and just as the sun was setting, he reached its outermost gates. The whole castle was surrounded by a deep moat, and the drawbridge and the gates and even the water in the moat were all of the same somber hue as the walls and towers. Upon the gate hung a huge bell, upon which was written in red letters, "Mortal, if thou art curious to know thy fate, strike this bell and submit to what shall befall thee." The prince, without the smallest hesitation, snatched up a great stone and hammered vigorously upon the bell, which gave forth a deep and terrible sound. The gate flew open and closed again with a thundering clang the moment the prince had passed through it, while from every tower and battlement rose a wheeling, screaming cloud of bats, which darkened the whole sky with their multitudes. Anyone but Prince Vivien would have been terrified by such an uncanny sight, but he strode stoutly forward till he reached the second gate, which was opened to him by 60 men covered from head to foot in long mantles. He wished to speak to them, but soon discovered that they spoke an utterly unknown language and did not seem to understand a word he said. This was a great aggravation to the prince, who was not accustomed to keep his ideas to himself, and he positively found himself wishing for his old friend Patience. However, he had to follow his guides in silence, and they led him into a magnificent hall. The floor was of ebony, the walls of jet, and all the hangings were of black velvet. But the prince looked round it in vain for something to eat, and then made signs that he was hungry. In the same manner, he was respectfully given to understand that he must wait. And after several hours, the 60 hooded and shrouded figures reappeared and conducted him with great ceremony, and also very, very slowly, to a banqueting hall, where they all placed themselves at a long table. The dishes were arranged down the center of it, and with his usual impetuosity, the prince seized the one that stood in front of him to draw it nearer, but soon found that it was fixed firmly in place. Then he looked at his solemn and lugubrious neighbors and saw that each one was supplied with a long, hollow reed through which he slowly sucked up his portion, and the prince was obliged to do the same, though he found it a frightfully tedious process. After supper, they returned as they had come to the ebony room, where he was compelled to look on while his companions played interminable games of chess, and not until he was nearly dying of weariness did they, slowly and ceremoniously as before, conduct him to his sleeping apartment. The hope of consulting the oracle woke him very early the next morning, and his first demand was to be allowed to present himself before it. But without replying, his attendants conducted him to a huge marble bath, very shallow at one end and quite deep at the other, and gave him to understand that he was to go into it. The prince, nothing loth, was for springing at once into deep water, but he was gently but forcibly held back and only allowed to stand where it was about an inch deep, and he was nearly wild with impatience when he found that this process was to be repeated every day in spite of all he could say or do, the water rising higher and higher by inches, so that for 60 days he had to live in perpetual silence, ceremoniously conducted to and fro, supping all his meals through the long reed, and looking on at innumerable games of chess, the game of all others which he detested most. But at last, The water rose as high as his chin, and his bath was complete. And that day, the men in their black robes, and each having a large bat perched upon his head, marched in slow procession with the prince in their midst, chanting a melancholy song, to the iron gate that led into a kind of temple. At the sound of their chanting, another band of men appeared and took possession of the unhappy Vivian. They looked to him exactly like the ones he had left, except that they moved more slowly still, and each one held a raven upon his wrist, and their harsh croakings re-echoed through the dismal place. Holding the prince by the arms, not so much to do him honor as to restrain his impatience, they proceeded by slow degrees up the steps of the temple. And when at last they reached the top, he thought his long waiting must be at an end. But on the contrary, after slowly enshrouding him in a long black robe like their own, they led him into the temple itself, where he was forced to witness numbers of lengthy rites and ceremonies. By this time, Vivian's active impatience had subsided into passive weariness. His yawns were continual and scandalous, but nobody heeded him. He stared hopelessly at the thick black curtain which hung down straight in front of him, and could hardly believe his eyes when it presently began to slide back, and he saw before him the black bird. It was of enormous size and was perched upon a thick bar of iron which ran across from one side of the temple to the other. At the sight of it, all the men fell upon their knees and hid their faces, and when it had three times flapped its mighty wings, it uttered distinctly in Prince Vivian's own language the words, "Prince, your only chance of happiness depends upon that which is most opposed to your own nature." Then the curtain fell before it once more, and the prince, after many ceremonies, was presented with a raven which perched upon his wrist, and was conducted slowly back to the iron gate. Here the raven left him, and he was handed over once more to the care of the first band of men, while a large bat flickered down and settled upon his head of its own accord. And so he was taken back to the marble bath and had to go through the whole process again. Only this time he began in deep water, which receded daily, inch by inch. When this was over, the men escorted him to the outer gate and took leave of him with every mark of esteem and politeness, to which it is to be feared he responded but indifferently, since the gate was no sooner opened than he took to his heels and fled away with all his might, his one idea being to put as much space as possible between himself and the dreary place into which he had ventured so rashly, just to consult a tedious oracle who, after all, had told him nothing. He actually reflected for about 5 seconds on his folly, and came to the conclusion that it might sometimes be advisable to think before one acted. After wandering about for several days until he was weary and hungry, he at last succeeded in finding a way out of the forest, and soon came to a wide and rapid river, which he followed, hoping to find some means of crossing it. And it happened that as the sun rose the next morning, he saw something of a dazzling whiteness moored out in the middle of the stream. Upon looking more attentively at it, he found that it was one of the prettiest little ships he had ever seen, and that the boat that belonged to it was made fast to the bank quite close to him. The prince was immediately seized with the most ardent desire to go on board the ship, and shouted loudly to attract the notice of her crew. But no one answered. So he sprang into the little boat and rowed away without finding it at all hard work, for the boat was made all of white paper and was light as a rose leaf. The ship was made of white paper, too, as the prince presently discovered when he reached it. He found not a soul on board, but there was a very cozy little bed in the cabin and an ample supply of all sorts of good things to eat and drink, which he made up his mind to enjoy until something new happened. Having been thoroughly well brought up at the court of King Gridelin, of course he understood the art of navigation. But when once he had started, the current carried the vessel down at such a pace that before he knew where he was, the prince found himself out at sea, and a wind springing up behind him just at this moment soon drove him out of sight of land. By this time he was somewhat alarmed and did his best to put the ship about and get back to the river. But wind and tide were too strong for him, and he began to think of the number of times from his childhood up that he had been warned not to meddle with water. But it was too late now to do anything but wish vainly that he had stayed on shore, and to grow heartily weary of the boat and the sea and everything connected with it. These two things, however, he did most thoroughly. To put the finishing touch to his misfortunes, he presently found himself becalmed in mid-ocean, a state of affairs which would be considered trying by the most patient of men. So you may imagine how well it affected Prince Vivian. He even came to wishing himself back at the castle of the Black Bird, for there at least he saw some living beings, whereas on board the white paper ship he was absolutely alone and could not imagine how he was ever to get away from his wearisome prison. However, after a very long time, he did see land, and his impatience to be on shore was so great that he at once flung himself over the ship's side that he might reach it sooner by swimming. But this was quite useless, for spring as far as he might from the vessel, it was always under his feet again before he reached the water, and he had to resign himself to this fate and wait with what patience he could muster until the winds and waves carried the ship into a kind of natural harbor which ran far into the land. After his long imprisonment at sea, the prince was delighted with the sight of the great trees which grew down to the very edge of the water, and leaping lightly on shore, he speedily lost himself in the thick forest. When he had wandered a long way, he stopped to rest beside a clear spring of water, but scarcely had he thrown himself down upon the mossy bank when there was a great rustling in the bushes close by, and out sprang a pretty little gazelle, panting and exhausted, which fell at his feet, gasping out, "Oh, Vivian, save me!" The prince, in great astonishment, leapt to his feet and had just time to draw his sword before he found himself face to face with a large green lion, which had been hotly pursuing the poor little gazelle. Prince Vivian attacked it gallantly, and a fierce combat ensued, which, however, ended before long in the prince's dealing his adversary a terrific blow, which felled him to the earth. As he fell, the lion whistled loudly three times with such force that the forest rang again, and the sound must have been heard for more than 2 leagues round, after which, having apparently nothing more to do in the world, he rolled over on his side and died. The prince, without paying any further heed to him or to his whistling, returned to the pretty gazelle, saying, "Well, are you satisfied now? Since you can talk, pray tell me instantly what all this is about and how you happen to know my name." "Oh, I must rest for a long time before I can talk," she replied. And beside, I very much doubt if you will have leisure to listen, for the affair is by no means over. In fact, she continued in the same languid tone, you had better look behind you now. The prince turned sharply round, and to his horror, saw a huge giant approaching with mighty strides, crying fiercely, who has made my lion whistle? I should like to know. I have, replied Prince Vivian boldly, but I can answer for it that he will not do it again. At these words, the giant began to howl and lament. Alas, my poor Tiny, my sweet little pet, he cried. But at least I can avenge thy death. Thereupon he rushed at the prince, brandishing an immense serpent, which was coiled about his wrist. Vivian, without losing his coolness, aimed a terrific blow at it with his sword. But no sooner did he touch the snake than it changed into a giant, and the giant into a snake, with such rapidity that the prince felt perfectly giddy. And this happened at least half a dozen times, till at last, with a fortunate stroke, he cut the serpent in halves, and picking up one morsel, flung it with all his force at the nose of the giant, who fell insensible on top of the lion. And in an instant, a thick black cloud rolled up, which hid them from view. And when it cleared away, they had all disappeared. Then the prince, without even waiting to sheathe his sword, rushed back to the gazelle, crying, now you have had plenty of time to recover your wits, and you have nothing more to fear. So tell me who you are, and what this horrible giant with his lion and his serpent have to do with you. And for pity's sake, be quick about it. I will tell you with pleasure, she answered. But where is the hurry? I want you to come back with me to the Green Castle. But I don't want to walk there, it is so far, and walking is so fatiguing. Let us set out at once, then, replied the prince severely, or else really I shall have to leave you where you are. Surely a young and active gazelle like you ought to be ashamed of not being able to walk a few steps. The further off this castle is, the faster we ought to walk. But as you don't appear to enjoy that, I will promise that we will go gently, and we can talk by the way. It would be better still if you would carry me, said she sweetly. But as I don't like to see people giving themselves trouble, you may carry me, and make that snail carry you. So saying, she pointed languidly with one tiny foot at what the prince had taken for a block of stone. But now he saw that it was a huge snail. What? I ride a snail? Cried the prince. You are laughing at me. And beside, we should not get there for a year. Oh, well then, don't do it, replied the gazelle. I am quite willing to stay here. The grass is green and the water clear. But if I were you, I should take the advice that was given me and ride the snail. So, though it did not please him at all, the prince took the gazelle in his arms and mounted upon the back of the snail, which glided along very peaceably, entirely declining to be hurried by frequent blows from the prince's heels. In vain did the gazelle represent to him that she was enjoying herself very much, and that this was the easiest mode of conveyance she had ever discovered. Prince Vivien was wild with impatience, and thought that the Green Castle would never be reached. However, at last they did get there, and everyone who was in it ran to see the prince dismount from his singular steed. But what was his surprise, when, having at her request set the gazelle gently down upon the steps which led up to the castle, he saw her suddenly change into a charming princess, and recognized in her his pretty cousin Placida, who greeted him with her usual tranquil sweetness. His delight knew no bounds, and he followed her eagerly up into the castle, impatient to know what strange events had brought her there. But after all, he had to wait for the princess's story, for the inhabitants of the Green Lands, hearing that the giant was dead, ran to offer the kingdom to his vanquisher, and Prince Vivian had to listen to various complimentary harangues, which took a great deal of time, though he cut them as short as politeness allowed, if not shorter. But at last he was free to rejoin Placida, who at once began the story of her adventures. "After you had gone away," said she, "they tried to make me learn how to govern the kingdom, which wearied me to death. So I begged and prayed Lolotte to take me away with her, and this she presently did, but very reluctantly. However, having been transported to her grotto upon my favorite couch, I spent several delicious days, soothed by the soft green light, which was like a beech wood in the spring, and by the murmuring of bees and the tinkle of falling water. But alas, Lolotte was forced to go away to a general assembly of the fairies, and she came back in great dismay, telling me that her indulgence to me had cost her dear, for she had been severely reprimanded and ordered to hand me over to the fairy Mirlefiche, who was already taking charge of you and who had been much commended for her management of you." "Fine management indeed," interrupted the prince, "if it is to her I owe all the adventures I've met with. But go on with your story, my cousin. I can tell you all about my doings afterwards, and then you can judge for yourself." "At first I was grieved to see Lolotte cry," resumed the princess. "But I soon found that grieving was very troublesome, so I thought it better to be calm, and very soon afterwards I saw the fairy Mirlefiche arrive, mounted upon her great unicorn. She stopped before the grotto and bade Lolotte bring me out to her, at which she cried worse than ever and kissed me a dozen times, but she dared not refuse. I was lifted up onto the unicorn behind Mirlefiche, who said to me, 'Hold on tight, little girl, if you don't want to break your neck.' And indeed, I had to hold on with all my might, for her horrible steed trotted so violently that it positively took my breath away. However, at last we stopped at a large farm, and the farmer and his wife ran out as soon as they saw the fairy and helped us to dismount. I knew that they were really a king and queen whom the fairies were punishing for their ignorance and idleness. You may imagine that I was by this time half dead with fatigue, but Mirlefiche insisted upon my feeding her unicorn before I did anything else. To accomplish this, I had to climb up a long ladder into the hayloft and bring down, one after another, 24 handfuls of hay. Never, never before did I have such a wearisome task. It makes me shudder to think of it now, and that was not all. In the same way, I had to carry the 24 handfuls of hay to the stable, and then it was supper time, and I had to go wait upon all the others. After that, I really thought I should be allowed to go peaceably to my little bed, but oh dear, no! First of all, I had to make it, for it was all in confusion. And then I had to make one for the fairy and tuck her in and draw the curtains round her, beside rendering her a dozen little services, which I was not at all accustomed to. Finally, when I was perfectly exhausted by all this toil, I was free to go to bed myself. But as I had never before undressed myself and really did not know how to begin, I lay down as I was. Unfortunately, the fairy found this out, and just as I was falling into a sweet slumber, She made me get up once more, but even then I managed to escape her vigilance and only took off my upper robe. Indeed, I may tell you in confidence that I always find disobedience answers very well. One is often scolded, it is true, but then one has been saved some trouble. At the earliest dawn of day, Mirlifiche woke me and made me take many journeys to the stable to bring her word of how her unicorn had slept and how much hay he had eaten, and then to find out what time it was and if it was a fine day. I was so slow and did my errands so badly that before she left, she called the king and queen and said to them, "I am much more impressed with you this year. Continue to make the best of your farm, if you wish to get back to your kingdom, and also take care of this little princess for me, and teach her to be useful, that when I come, I may find her cured of her faults. If she is not..." Here she broke off with a significant look, and mounting my enemy, the unicorn, speedily disappeared. Then the king and queen, turning to me, asked me what I could do. "Nothing at all, I assure you," I replied in a tone which really ought to have convinced them. But they went on to describe various employments and tried to discover which of them would be most to my taste. However, at last I persuaded them to do nothing whatever would be the only thing that would suit me, and that if they really wanted to be kind to me, they would let me go to bed and to sleep, and not to tease me about doing anything. To my great joy, they not only permitted this, but actually when they had their own meals, the queen brought my portion up to me. But early the next morning she appeared at my bedside, saying with an apologetic air, "My pretty child, I am afraid you must really make up your mind to get up today. I know quite well how delightful it is to be thoroughly idle. For when my husband and I were king and queen, we did nothing at all from morning to night. And I sincerely hope that it will not be long before those happy days will come again for us. But at present, we have not reached them, nor have you. And you know, from what the fairy said, that perhaps worse things may happen to us if she is not obeyed. Make haste, I beg of you, and come down to breakfast, for I have put by some delicious cream for you." It was really very tiresome, but as there was no help for it, I went down. But the instant breakfast was over, they began again their cuckoo cry of, "What will you do?" And in vain did I... whatever. "Nothing at all, if it please you, madam." The queen at last gave me a spindle and about 4 pounds of hemp upon a distaff and sent me out to keep the sheep, assuring me that there could not be a pleasanter occupation, and that I could take my ease as much as I pleased. I was forced to set out, very unwillingly, as you may imagine, but I had not walked far before I came to a shady bank in what seemed to me a charming place. I stretched myself cozily upon the soft grass, and with the bundle of hemp for a pillow, slept as tranquilly as if there were no such things as sheep in the world, while they, for their part, wandered hither and thither at their own sweet will, as if there were no such thing as a shepherdess, invading every field and browsing upon every kind of forbidden dainty, until the peasants, alarmed by the havoc they were making, raised a clamor, which at last reached the ears of the king and queen, who ran out, and seeing the cause of the commotion, hastily collected their flock. And indeed, the sooner the better, since they had to pay for all the damage they had done. As for me, I lay still and watched them run, for I was very comfortable, and there I might be still if they had not caught up, all panting and breathless, and compelled me to get up and follow them. They also represented me bitterly, but I need hardly tell you that they did not again entrust me with the flock. But whatever they found for me to do, it was always the same thing. I spoilt and mismanaged it all, and was so successful in provoking even the most talented people, that one day I ran away from the farm, for I was really afraid the queen would be obliged to beat me. When I came to the little river in which the king used to fish, I found the boat tied to a tree, and stepping in, I unfastened it and floated gently down with the current. The gliding of the boat was so soothing that I did not trouble myself in the least when the queen caught sight of me and ran along the bank, crying, "My boat! My boat! Husband, come and catch the little princess who is running away with my boat!" The current soon carried me out of the hearing of her cries, and I dreamed to the song of the ripples and the whisper of the trees until the boat suddenly stopped, and I found it was stuck fast beside a fresh green meadow, and that the sun was rising. In the distance, I saw some little houses which seemed to be built in a most singular fashion. But as I was by this time very hungry, I set out towards them. But before I had walked many steps, I saw that the air was full of shining objects which seemed to be fixed, and yet I could not see what they hung from. I went nearer and saw a silken cord hanging down to the ground and pulled it just because it was so close to my hand. Instantly, the whole meadow resounded to the melodious chiming of a peal of silver bells, and they sounded so pretty that I sat down to listen and to watch them as they swung shining in the sunbeams. Before they ceased to sound came a great flight of birds, and each one perching upon a bell added its charming song to the concert. As they ended, I looked up and saw a tall and stately dame advancing towards me, surrounded and followed by a vast flock of every kind of bird. "Who are you, little girl?" said she, "who dares to come where I allow no mortal to live, lest my birds should be disturbed? Still, if you are clever at anything," she added, "I might be able to put up with your presence." "Madam," I answered, rising, "you may be very sure that I shall not do anything to alarm your birds. I only beg you, for pity's sake, to give me something to eat." "I will do that," she replied, "before I send you where you deserve to go." And thereupon she dispatched 6 jays, who were her pages, to fetch me all sorts of biscuits, while some of the other birds brought ripe fruits. In fact, I had a delicious breakfast, though I do not like to be waited upon so quickly. It is so disagreeable to be hurried. I began to think I should like very well to stay in this pleasant country, and I said so to the stately lady, but she answered with the greatest disdain, "Do you think I would keep you here? You? Why, what do you suppose would be the good of you in this country, where everybody is wide awake and busy? No, no, I have shown you all the hospitality you will get from me." With these words, she turned and gave a vigorous pull to the silken rope, which I mentioned before. But instead of a melodious chime, there arose a hideous clanging which quite terrified me. And in an instant, a huge black bird appeared, which alighted at the fairy's feet, saying in a frightful voice, "What do you want of me, my sister?" "I wish you to take this little princess to my cousin, the giant of the green castle, at once," she replied, "and beg him from me to make her work day and night upon his beautiful tapestry." At these words, the great bird snatched me up, regardless of my cries, and flew off at a terrific pace. "Oh, you are joking, cousin," interrupted Prince Vivian. "You mean as slowly as possible. I know that horrible blackbird and the lengthiness of all his proceedings and surroundings." "Have it your own way," replied Placida tranquilly. "I cannot bear arguing. Perhaps this was not even the same bird. At any rate, he carried me off at a prodigious speed and set me gently down in this very castle of which you are now the master. We entered by one of the windows, and when the bird had handed me over to the giant from whom you have been good enough to deliver me and given the fairy's message, it departed. Then the giant turned to me, saying, 'So you are an idler. Ah, well, we must teach you to work. You won't be the first we have cured of laziness. See how are. Spindles, skeins of wool, patterns, and all necessary things. Before each frame, about a dozen people were sitting hard at work, at which terrible sight I fainted away. And as soon as I recovered, they began to ask me what I could do. It was in vain that I replied as before, and with the strongest desire to be taken at my word, 'Nothing at all.' The giant only said, 'Then you must learn to do something. In this world, there is enough work for everybody.' It appeared that they were working into the tapestry all the stories the fairies liked best, and they began to try and teach me to help them. But from the first class where they tried me to begin with, I sank lower and lower, and not even the most simple stitches could I learn. In vain they punished me by all the usual methods. In vain the giant showed me his menagerie, which was entirely composed of children who would not work. Nothing did me any good, and at last I was reduced to drawing water for the dyeing of the wools. And even over that I was so slow that this morning the giant flew into a rage and changed me into a gazelle. He was just putting me into the menagerie when I happened to catch sight of a dog and was seized with such terror that I fled away at my utmost speed and escaped through the outer court of the castle. The giant, fearing that I should be lost altogether, sent his green lion after me with orders to bring me back, cost what it might, and I should certainly have let myself be caught or eaten up or anything rather than run any further if I had not luckily met you by the fountain. And oh," concluded the princess, "how delightful it is once more to be able to sit still in peace. I was so tired of trying to learn things." Prince Vivian said that for his part, he had been kept a great deal too still and had not found it at all amusing. And then he recounted all his adventures with breathless rapidity, how he had taken shelter with Dame Patience and consulted the oracle and voyaged in the paper ship. Then they went hand in hand to release all the prisoners in the castle and all the princes and princesses who were in cages in the menagerie. For the instant the green giant was dead, they had resumed their natural forms. As you may imagine, they were all very grateful, and Princess Placida entreated them never, never to do another stitch of work as long as they lived, and they promptly made a great bonfire in the courtyard and solemnly burnt all the embroidery frames and spinning wheels. Then the princess gave them splendid presents, or rather sat by while Prince Vivian gave them, and there were great rejoicings in the green castle, and everyone did his best to please the prince and princess. But with all their good intentions, they often made mistakes, for Vivian and Placida were never of one mind about their plan, so it was very confusing, and they frequently found themselves obeying the prince's orders very, very slowly, and rushing off with lightning speed to do something that the princess did not wish to have done at all until, by and by, The two cousins took to consulting with and consoling one another in all these little vexations, and at last came to be so fond of each other that for Placida's sake, Vivian became quite patient, and for Vivian's sake, Placida made the most unheard-of exertions. But now, the fairies, who had been watching all these proceedings with interest, thought it was time to interfere and ascertain by further trials if this improvement was likely to continue and if they really loved one another. So they caused Placida to seem to have a violent fever and Vivian to languish and grow dull, and made each of them very uneasy about the other. And then, finding a moment when they were apart, the fairy Mirlefiche suddenly appeared to Placida and said, "I have just seen Prince Vivian, and he seemed to me to be very ill." "Alas, yes, madam," she answered, "and if you will but cure him, you may take me back to the farm, or bring the green giant to life again, and you shall see how obedient I will be." "If you really wish him to recover," said the fairy, "you have only to catch the trotting mouse and the chaffinch on the wing and bring them to me. Only remember, time presses." She had hardly finished speaking before the princess was rushing headlong out of the castle gate, and the fairy, after watching her till she was lost to sight, gave a little chuckle and went in search of the prince, who begged her earnestly to send him back to the Black Castle or to the paper boat if she would but save Placida's life. The fairy shook her head and looked very grave. She quite agreed with him. The princess was in a bad way. "But," said she, "if you can find the rosy mole and give him to her, she will recover." So now it was the prince's turn to set off in a vast hurry. Only as soon as he left the castle, he happened to go in exactly the opposite direction to the one Placida had taken. Now you can imagine these two devoted lovers hunting night and day, the princess in the woods, always running, always listening, pursuing hotly after two creatures which seemed to her very hard to catch, which she had never yet ceased from pursuing. The prince, on the other hand, wandering continually across the meadows, his eyes fixed upon the ground, attentive to every movement among the moles. He was forced to walk slowly, slowly upon tiptoe, hardly venturing to breathe. Often he stood for hours and motionless as a statue, and if the desire to succeed could have helped him, he would soon have possessed the rosy mole. But alas, all that he caught were black and ordinary, though strange to say, he never grew impatient, but always seemed ready to begin the tedious hunt again. But this changing of character is one of the most ordinary miracles which love works. Neither the prince nor the princess gave a thought to anything but their quest. It never even occurred to them to wonder what country they had reached. So, you may guess how astonished they were one day, when, having at last been successful after their long and weary chase, they cried aloud at the same instant, "At last I have saved my beloved!" And then, recognizing each other's voices, looked up and rushed to meet one another with the wildest joy. Surprise kept them silent, while for one delicious moment they gazed into each other's eyes. And just then who should come up but King Gridelin, for it was into his kingdom they had accidentally strayed. He recognized them in his turn and greeted them joyfully. But when they turned afterwards to look for the rosy mole, the chaffinch, and the trotting mouse, they had vanished. And in their places stood a lovely lady whom they did not know, the black bird, and the green giant. King Gridelin had no sooner set eyes upon the lady than with a cry of joy he clasped her in his arms, for it was no other than his long-lost wife Santorina, about whose imprisonment in Fairyland you may perhaps read some day. Then the black bird and the green giant resumed their natural form, for they were enchanters. And up flew Lolotte and Mirlefiche in their chariots. And then there was a great kissing and congratulating, for everybody had regained someone he had loved, including the enchanters, who loved their natural forms dearly. After this, they repaired to the palace, and the wedding of Prince Vivienne and Princess Placida was held at once with all the splendor imaginable. King Gridelin and Queen Santorina, after all their experiences, had no further desire to reign, so they retired happily to a peaceful place, leaving their kingdom to the prince and the princess, who were beloved by all their subjects, and found their greatest happiness all their lives long in making other people happy. That was Prince Vivienne and the Princess Placida from Andrew Lang's Green Fairy Book. Special thanks to Ginger Sands for our theme music. You can find more of Ginger's music at iTunes or on her website at www.gingersands.com. And if you'd like to comment on today's story, send me an email. I can be reached at susan.poulter, that's P-O-U-L-T-E-R, at nashville.gov. Thanks for listening.